natural skincare is not always better. It just simply is not. And this is where greenwashing and all of these marketing things come in.
You're listening to Made Better, a show exploring the power of creating and consuming more consciously for a healthier planet and perspective. I'm your host, Susanna Jaffa. Each episode, I connect with inspiring individuals to chat about the impact of what we wear, from clothing to cosmetics, and discuss how we can all journey to making better choices and why it matters. Join us each week as we shift the narrative around consumption, one conversation at a time. Hey everyone, we're back. Welcome to yet another episode of the Made Better podcast. Thank you so much for all the feedback on this show so far, and please keep it coming. What topics would you like to hear about, or guests would you like to hear from? I want to know. You can email me directly at susanna@zarin.com or just DM me on Instagram. I'd love to hear from you. So on today's show, we're not talking about clothes. We're diving into all things skincare and the topic of sustainable beauty specifically. Just like the slow fashion movement, green beauty is officially on the rise. In a big contrast to 5 years ago, there are now more and more brands developing products using cleaner, toxin-free ingredients or harnessing the healing properties of botanicals. And it's for good reason. The conventional beauty industry is still worryingly under-regulated. Companies are still able to get away with using a slew of ingredients linked with health concerns or using misleading adjectives to market and greenwash potentially harmful formulations. Back in my previous career, I actually used to write about beauty too. And even as an industry insider, I was often confused about what actually qualifies as natural beauty. There are so many terms out there, like green, clean, cruelty-free, vegan, ethical, associated with skincare. But what do they actually mean? And is natural skincare really better for your complexion than, well, drugstore-bought products? While I've learned a lot through diving into the sustainability space, there's nothing like hearing from experts or advocates who live and breathe the topic to really clear up everything for you. And that's exactly what went down with our guest on this episode, Janae Rostorf. She's the founder of Lux Botanics, a beauty brand which is all about harnessing the power of effective and ethically sourced botanicals to transform and truly nurture your skin. Janae has had a fascinating and very international former career as a biological scientist and is just brimming with insights about the beauty space. Today, the skincare entrepreneur has dedicated herself to transforming the industry by combining science with ethics to be at the forefront of what she calls beauty activism. This chat took us from her roots in South Africa and how it eventually inspired her brand, to demystifying what sustainable skincare actually should be and what all the jargon means, from greenwashing to recycling to certifications to why she prefers to avoid the word natural, she gives so many fresh perspectives. Whether you're simply a concerned citizen looking to buy better beauty or a business owner looking for inspiration and insights, there's really something for everyone to take away. Anyway, that's enough from me. Let's get into it. Hey, Janae, and welcome to the show.
Hi, Susanna. Thanks for having me. It's a great pleasure to be here with you.
Yes, I'm really, really excited to have this conversation. And I feel like it's been a long time coming. I've loved watching your journey with Lux Botanics and seeing how vocal you and your team have been about changing the standards of the beauty industry and the skincare industry. And yeah, I'm really excited to learn more about your journey here.
Great. Fantastic. Looking forward to getting into it.
Yes. And so with that, let's get into it. I'd love to know more about your personal background, your career in science, which is super interesting, and how you first came into the skincare space.
Sure. So I'm sure you can hear from my accent. I am South African. I grew up in South Africa, very much immersed in nature. I didn't grow up in the city. And I grew up with a family that was regularly involved in going to the bush and exploring the nature around us. And at 19, I was lucky enough to be accepted to of biotechnology and bioethics. And I realized kind of doing that technology side that I wanted to work in the clinical and medical space. So I ended up working for pharmaceutical companies for 10 years. And I was deeply involved in the clinical trial space. So all the way from lab bench research through to your phase one, two, and three clinical trials and post-clinical studies. And the areas that I was working in were oncology and dermatology. And this journey took me from Brisbane and Sydney all the way to Singapore, where we met Susanna way back in 2012. And I found myself at that point really missing my home of South Africa. At that point, I'd been out of South Africa for about 14 years, and I just felt that I needed to do something to tie me back to my home and this nature and this bush that I'd grown up in. So in 2012, I took a trip from Singapore to Tanzania to kind of reconnect with my roots. And I found myself in Nguruguru Crater, which is the cradle of man. It's where mankind come from, as far as we know. And I found myself sitting on the edge of that crater, looking at this beautiful, wondrous nature, and thinking about, what am I going to do with my life to tie back to this feeling of home, of nature, of, and anyone who's been to that area in Africa will tell you, no matter where you grew up in the world, you come back there and you just have the sense of home. So I went back to Singapore, and it took me another 3 years to realize what I was going to do. And Lux Botanics was born at the end of 2015 when I left my pharmaceutical career. And it also comes from the fact that I grew up with very sensitive acneic skin. You know, I was one of those kids that was on Roaccutane from a very young age. I had many facials from when I was about 10 or 11. And my mom just really emphasized on me the need to take care of your skin. So when I left my pharmaceutical career in 2015 and was kind of trying to find that thing to tie me back to Africa, I pulled in the skincare, this what I have been dealing with my whole life, to my scientific career, and Lux Botanics was born.
That's really, really fascinating, actually. I think it's really, you know, poignant to hear about that journey and like returning to South Africa and where that spark of inspiration really, you know, came from. And with that, Lux Botanics as a skincare label now today, your some of your star botanical ingredients, all actually, I think all of your star botanical ingredients are tied to South Africa, your birth country. Tell me more about your sourcing journey and more about their significance.
Sure. So when I went on this journey of starting Lux Botanics, I had two key principles in mind that I wanted to adhere to. And the first is obviously science, scientific efficacy. I mean, I've spent 10 years in this industry doing clinical trials. So I wanted to find something, an ingredient that had meaningful scientific evidence. But also, as I said, something that would tie me back to my home of Africa and some way that I could help, even if it was from afar. So I went on this journey to find scientifically effective ingredients that could also uplift communities. And, you know, I kind of went back to my roots. You know, marula trees and Kigelia africana trees are things that you see in South Africa. You have them in your backyard. You smell marula oil on people's skin when you hug them hello. So those were the immediate botanicals that I went towards. And I actually originally had 9 botanicals that I assessed, but I managed to cut it down to the marula oil, which comes actually from Kenya, the Kigelia africana, which comes from Malawi. And then I actually really struggled to find a vitamin C botanical in Africa that didn't oxidize and had a very, very high level of vitamin C. So I actually had to go to Brazil to find the Camu Camu berry there. And throughout this journey of finding those ingredients, as I say, they were chosen because they have published scientific evidence for the benefits of your skin, for the compatibility to your skin, as well as then the communities that we source them from. So it's not just a farm. It's a community-run organization that is giving the local community a fair trade living, if not helping them set this up themselves, but also importantly, giving back to that community too. So it's not just a fair trade living farming situation, which you see with a lot of natural skincare ingredients. There is a strong element of community upliftment through that cooperative as well.
And tell me more about the actual properties of the different ingredients. I know you mentioned, you know, Camu Camu is excellent for brightening with the, you know, potent vitamin C concentration. Tell me more about Kigelia and Marula, because I know that they kind of have different properties and could work well for, you know, different skin concerns as well.
Definitely. So Lux Botanics as a brand, because we've chosen these 3 botanicals, has 3 very different distinct lines that suit very different skin types and skin concerns. So marula oil, for example, is a very high oleic acid oil. Now, oleic acid is one of the heavier fatty acid chains, so it's deeply hydrating. It's also because of its structure, it increases skin permeability. So it's going to pull into your skin any of the other ingredients that are in that formulation or anything that's already on your skin. So that being a much more hydrating oil is generally for a more dry, perhaps mature or premature aging skin type. For me personally, when I get on a plane and I'm traveling, that's what I slather on my skin. It's the only thing that keeps my skin hydrated. The Kigelia Africana is a really interesting one because I always explain to people and I say, perhaps when you were growing up, if you cut yourself or you had an insect bite, you might have used a little aloe vera leaf or something and put that directly on your skin. Well, Kigelia Africana has the same kind of use in Africa. It's this massive sausage-shaped fruit that hangs from the tree, so that's why it's called a sausage fruit. And it's the kind of thing that you would take down, cut, and put directly on your skin to heal anything from acne to an infected bite to sunburn, eczema, psoriasis, all of those sort of things. So that ingredient in our Kigelia line is really, really fantastic for people that have skin very similar to mine, sensitive, acneic, perhaps prone to infection. So it really is a very specific but very active ingredient as well. And then the Camu Camu, as you said, it's fantastic for brightening because Camu Camu, depending on the harvesting season, of course, is one of the highest vitamin C's in nature. And what makes ours really special is that the berry is cold pressed whole. So it's not like we're going in and just removing the allosorbic acid, right? We're actually presenting to you a whole botanical oil with all of the natural ingredients that it had growing in nature. So it doesn't oxidize easily. It has many different forms of vitamin C and other antioxidants in it. So it's so much more than just a single allosorbic acid molecule.
Amazing. Yeah. And I think that, you know, the formulations, having experienced them myself as well through using the products, I personally love the Kigelia. I think it's very soothing and doesn't strip your skin, but I can definitely see a difference when I've used it for a consistent amount of time. You can really see, you know, that reduced redness. I suffer from a lot of redness in my skin. You can really see that difference with consistent use.
It really makes a huge difference.
Yeah. It's a little warrior for your skin, I think. And I know that along with your sourcing journey, utilizing these amazing botanicals, I know that you also have used this process as a way to give back as a company as well. I know that you have been working with the organization Buy One, Give One for a while. Could you tell me more about that journey as well?
For sure. So that was from the beginning of the founding of the brand. I wanted to make sure that we had a robust give back program. As I said, you know, on the journey, it was all about that reconnection back to Africa and how we can uplift communities through their own initiatives. So one of the ways is how we source our botanicals. That's a very key way that we can help to uplift communities from within. But then second to that, I wanted to look for a charitable partner that was truly effective and could also measure their impact. And that's where I came upon Paul and Masami from Buy One, Give One in Singapore. And they have this incredible model of literally, if you buy something, you should give something. The idea came to her in Cambodia where she saw children that had lost their sight. And she was thinking, if we could somehow help them to regain their sight just by someone buying a TV, or if a child had lost their hearing, perhaps we could help them with a hearing aid just by someone buying a radio. So something simple that had a measurable effect. But the other side that I love about Buy One, Give One is how detailed they are with their auditing of the partners that they work with. So, you know, making sure that financially everything is tracked and it's utilized, but also helping them plan their projects. But I think perhaps the most key thing in looking for any charitable partner, and I say this to anyone in any business, is ensuring that that partner is respecting what the community wants. Not just going in and saying, oh, I'm going to build you a school. You know, I don't know if you need a school, but I'm going to build you a school. We really have to make sure when we uplift communities around the world that we do it by making sure we're doing what they want for them and it's led by them. We should never, ever come in and tell someone else what to do because we think our way is right or whatever we may think, because generally it's not. So we have to really, really make sure that we're uplifting from within and that it is always community led.
Yeah, and by the sounds of it, very much with a philosophy of co-creation. And, you know, yeah, I think that that's crucial ultimately, because you want to be able to, if you are donating funds, donating time, ultimately you want it to be able to help that community thrive in the long term by themselves as well. Yeah, I think that's fantastic. And being in the green beauty space, which Lux Botanics definitely occupies, I have been really fascinated with the way the industry and this whole movement has shaped over the last few years. And with that, you know, just like the sustainable fashion movement, the green beauty space has become full of myths and misconceptions. And I'd love to hear from you a bit of demystifying, because I know this is something that you're really passionate about as well. And, you know, what terms like green, clean, natural really mean? And perhaps you could shed light on how they're utilized today and what your thoughts are on that.
One of my favorite topics.
Yes, we've talked about it before.
Definitely. We could talk about this for hours. What I will say is, someone sitting within the industry, is that the first term to kind of come to light was clean. That's been around for maybe about 10 years, and it's become synonymous with a brand that doesn't use potentially harmful ingredients, hormone disruptors, carcinogens, things like that. And I feel like that's what maybe started the movement, but green is what has taken the movement forward. I'll give you an example. So Sephora released the Clean at Sephora program around 3 years ago, maybe 4 years ago now. And it's been widely, it's a huge disappointment in our industry. There's no other way to say it, because they just went completely lax with the things that they could have asked brands to do. And they made the bar really, really low for brands to meet. Now, fast forward to using the word green. Green to someone in our industry means so much more than clean. It's not just avoiding potentially harmful ingredients. It's also potentially harmful ingredients for the earth, for the planet, for the people. It's also your packaging. It's the life cycle of your product. It's the way that you as your business make daily decisions that are ethical and sustainable. So it takes it leaps and bounds beyond just a formulation conversation, which in some ways I would argue has perhaps gone too far and banned things that are actually not harmful. So there's a whole scientific conversation to be had. But green really brings us into, as I say, a holistic space, a holistic view of what a business should be in this space and how you make your decisions for your formulation from a scientific perspective, from a planet perspective, and from a people perspective.
And terms like natural, I think, have become quite vague. And I think that coming into this space as a consumer, that's one of the first words that I heard, more natural beauty. You know, try using more natural beauty options, Susanna, like, you know, for my skincare issues. You know, I'd look to formulations that were more soothing and plant-based. And I was looking for these originally in drugstores, you know, your typical kind of Boots in the UK, etc., and looking at sort of already existing brands that have sort of more natural or purportedly natural lines. Now come to realize that a lot of this is just marketing. And I'd love for you to share a bit more about that as well, because, you know, the beauty industry is unregulated. The term natural, as I understand, is really unregulated, right?
That's completely why I tend to avoid using it, because I think we've gotten to a point where greenwashing is just everywhere. And I think we really have to be careful when we use these terms, because when you talked about natural 10 years ago, you were probably thinking of a CO2 extracted or a cold pressed ingredient, which is just simply a plant that is, you know, plant, leaf, stem, fruit, whatever it may be, that's been extracted in a very, very simple process. Where we sit right now, we also know that some of those ingredients, though they may be natural, are incredibly harmful to the planet in the way that they farmed and to the communities whose lives have literally been bulldozed over to expand these fields and expand corporate profit, right? So I don't like to use the word natural so much anymore. And then to juxtapose that with the word synthetic, that has also now been demonized, where people are so worried about synthetic ingredients because they just immediately assume they must be toxic. And that's where the scientist in me kind of has this knee-jerk reaction, like, no. Synthetic can be a really good thing. So at Lux, we like to use the word ethical synthetic. And that means where we've made either something derived directly from nature, or we've synthesized something in the lab that has the exact same chemical componentry and design as that natural object, but it didn't come at the expense of the planet and the people around it. So that's why I tend to avoid the word natural. And if we're going to have a conversation about the word natural, we have to consider what is natural really, and what is an ethical synthetic, and how do we create a formulation that brings together effectiveness for the person using it, but is not causing harm to people and planet.
Yeah, I think that's really, really fascinating. I mean, do you have an example within your own line of an ingredient that is synthesized and the reason you chose to do that, just to illustrate, you know, that point?
Sure. So I think probably there's a couple. One I would say is peptides. So peptides often come from an animal source. You can get them from plants as well, but generally it's plants in a monoculture. So we chose to synthesize them in a lab. And that means we also get them much faster, in a much cleaner way. They bio-fermented in big fermenters. And it really is something that is giving you the exact same efficacy, but without that monoculture. Another one might be sodium hyaluronate that, as you know, comes from animals it's just not really a great source. But also by synthesizing that in the lab, we are reducing our reliance on an industry that isn't good for the planet.
Yeah, I think that's really fascinating and a really fresh perspective for people to hear, because as you say, synthetic is very kind of demonized now. And I think that it's not always that black and white. There are shades of gray that I think we, as both consumers and within the industry as well, and perhaps entrepreneurs who are coming into this industry as well, to or aspiring, you know, skincare entrepreneurs could also educate and learn from that for sure. And yeah, with that, I think, believe you had a LinkedIn post on this that I looked at the other day, and it was really fascinating. Oh no, it was actually on Instagram. You were sharing about the efficacy of natural skincare and the fact that sometimes natural skincare may not always be better. And you shared that actually, you know, it's the quality of the formulation that should be the focus. And I just found that really fascinating to watch and listen to that perspective. So, I mean, my question is, if natural isn't always better, could you share why? I think you've touched on this, but sharing why and perhaps some examples.
Definitely. And you know, I'll back up a little bit and say, I'm very grateful in a way, and this is going to sound strange, for the way that consumer behavior has changed during the pandemic, that people have started to realize that just by choosing something natural isn't always better, and that science is really important in the way that we make things. So, you know, leading into that, natural skincare is not always better. It just simply is not. And this is where greenwashing and all of these marketing things come in, because if you often see a brand that launches and says, oh, they're natural, and you actually look at their ingredients, there's two things you need to look at. There's quality of ingredient and there's formulation. Because as I see a lot with, for example, marula suppliers, you can farm marula in so many areas of Africa, but the quality of that marula fruit and ultimately the oil that you get from the kernel is not going to be anything compared to a naturally wild grown marula fruit, right? So if you see a natural brand come out and they say they've got marula oil, you want to know, where does it come from? Because that's going to answer your quality question. Then you want to look at the formulation, because as I'm sure you know, we are required by law to list ingredients in order in the formulation of highest percentage to lowest percentage. But that's not everything. Reading an inky list is not just everything, because certain ingredients, when you get them from a manufacturer, they'll tell you that they can be formulated for between 2 and 10% of the formulation, right? And what a lot of brands will do is they'll put them in at the absolute lowest percentage that they can, just to be able to say that they've put passion fruit in, or they've put, I don't know, lime oil or something. But it will be at such an incredibly low percentage that it will not be active for your skin at all. And then in my mind, it becomes a completely wasteful formulation, you shouldn't even be using that ingredient if it's not going to have an activity on the skin. And this is where it leads all the way back around to damage to people and planet, because why are we farming these things or making these things only to be used in formulations that are not active in your skin and are actually, in my opinion, actively harming the planet?
Well, I think that that's actually blown my mind a bit, you know, to think of it in that way, to be honest. You know, I look at the back of skincare, you know, when I go into drugstores, et cetera, we've had to go in, you know, to buy COVID tests a lot recently. I always look at the back of formulations and ingredients now, just as I've gotten into the habit of reading tags, labels, you know, on clothes. And there's a lot of opacity, essentially. And I think lack of transparency. And I speak as someone who's in this space and aware. I know that, you know, back in the day when I was, you know, your typical sort of, I guess you could say, fast fashion consumer, or I was just not mindful, I should say, of the things that I was wearing or the things I was putting on my skin. I would never look at these things. I was like, oh, you know, this, you know, great body scrub or this great cleanser hat, it is greenwashing. It's, you're attracted by perhaps this trendy ingredient, perhaps passion fruit, or perhaps it's, you know, citrus orange, or there is the whole, I think, the marketing of a lot of, you know, fruit and natural ingredients within a lot of skincare. But actually, when you look at the formulations on the back, and I actually had one of these in my bathroom the other day, and I realized, actually, yeah, the percentages, it just doesn't make any sense. And I feel like there's a lot of read between the lining that you need to do, which the everyday consumer doesn't necessarily have, which makes it even more easy for brands to be vague, to greenwash, to get away with putting out formulations that suggest that they will offer one thing, but actually don't deliver on that at all. Yeah.
No, I mean, I'll give you one example. I remember years ago in Singapore going into Watson's and seeing this Marilla body wash and thinking, oh, okay, cool. It's got Marilla in it, you know, and reading the inky on the back, and Marilla was the last ingredient. Mm. So less than 0.1%.
Yeah.
I remember thinking, this is greenwashing. This is what that means. Because Marilla, I mean, to have any kind of effect on your skin should be about 60% of formulation. So, yeah. You know, but I think the problem as well is reading and inking, even for someone like me, without actually seeing the brand's formulation, it is extremely hard to know if what they put in, they've used at the recommended percentages or not. It's incredibly hard. So I think it comes back to getting to know the brand, looking at things like their website. Do they have a statement of corporate responsibility? Do they tell you how they formulate? Do they tell you where they get their ingredients? Because it's not just enough anymore to slap an organic logo on something or say that you're vegan or cruelty-free. It is just not enough. There's so much greenwashing happening around that.
Yes, yes, yes. I 100% agree with you. And I think just as there's, you know, huge conversations around transparency in fashion, equally the same goes for the beauty, cosmetics, skincare industry. You know, there's a lot of strides that I feel that need to be made. And again, I think that this will also come with more regulation. And yeah. And speaking of regulation and, you know, perhaps moving into the area of certifications, congratulations on your recent cosmetically active certification, which I read about. And I understand that, you know, the mark represents the highest standards of efficacy in natural beauty. Could you tell me more about what that process was like for the certification, and also what other reputable certifications people can look out for, and if that should be the only thing that consumers are looking out for?
So first of all, certification should never be everything. I'll give you an example. So our Marilla oil is wild harvested. It's grown from trees that have been there for generations, and it will never, ever be a certified organic plantation, because it's not going to be just planted and farmed. So when people ask me, why isn't your Marilla oil certified organic, I have to kind of explain that. So to me, that is an extremely high quality Marilla oil, and I would rather use that because of its effects on people and planet than buy a certified organic. So that's one example of where I think certifications don't mean everything. But second to that, talking about something like cosmetically active, which, by the way, took us about 2.5 years to get, and we're one of only 13 brands globally to have it so far. Cosmetically active is, to my knowledge now, the only certification globally that looks at natural skincare as a holistic item. It looks at it not just from an ingredient perspective, but a formulation and skin compatibility perspective. So many of these certifications that you'll see, things like EWG you might see, or MadeSafe or Clean Cert, any of the ones really floating around in the US, they tend to only look ingredient. So where does it come from? Does it bioaccumulate? How long is it going to stay in our environment before it disappears? They don't look at what is that ingredient doing on your skin? Is there scientific evidence for it? Not just, a small petri dish study, but an actual real life study. And how compatible is it? And then how are those ingredients used together harmoniously in a formulation to make an effective skincare product? And lastly, are your claims ethical? So if we say we have vitamin C and it's potent, is that an ethical claim according to the percentage that we've used in our formulation? So it was quite a journey to get this certification, and it has meant a huge amount to me as a scientist to finally have something that represents a natural skincare brand actually being effective for people and the planet that it's coming from, right? So those ingredients are going to biodegrade really easily. They're not going to accumulate the environment. They're also not coming from places that are exploiting people, and they're going to have a positive effect on your skin and a measurable effect on your skin. So I think that's a really meaningful certification for people to look at. I know there's only 13 brands right now, but support those 13 brands. And I'm really hoping that it will gain momentum as people start to understand what it means and how much it helps us fight greenwashing in this space.
And I understand that you've also started a B Corp application, I believe.
We have. It's a long journey, but we have. It's really helped me as an entrepreneur, because I started this journey obviously with this, this big idea of wanting to help people and planet, but also having an effective skincare line. And going through the B Corp questions makes you realize how much more there is to do. And to some people that might be daunting. I'm actually really excited by it. And there's just so many new conversations happening because of this process that we're going through. So that's another one. As soon as we can get that, I'm going to be incredibly proud. I know it's probably going to take a year or a year and a half. But please support the brands out there that are B Corps, because they are held through their corporate policies to making ethical, sustainable, and responsible decisions.
Yes, and I think the B Corp website, just in general, is a great framework for brands to kind of benchmark themselves against and benchmark their progress and where, like you said, where they need to go. I think we're also looking into it as well as a platform, and it is rigorous. Really, it is the elements of business, supply chain, sourcing, energy, all of your utilization of everything. It's really scrutinized. And I think that the bar is just set so high, and exactly as you say, any B Corp, I think you should really applaud, because it is the real deal. It is a real process, and I think the standard for sustainability and ethics is just set so high. I'm really excited to hear more about the cosmetically active. I'm going to keep an eye on that, and I'm also going to look up the other brands as well, because I think that that's a really, really great, great new option for the beauty industry. I hope that it really takes off. I hope more brands sort of look to applying for it. It's states-based, the team?
It's actually from Europe. It's a European brand. It's they actually wrote one of the very first natural cosmetics textbooks a couple of years ago. And on the back of this research they've done for this, it's actually now a series of textbooks, they've created the certification.
Amazing. I'm going to look up more on that. And talking about beauty industry standards, another thing that the beauty industry, skincare, cosmetics industry finds difficult is recycling and waste. Again, just like fashion, just like any consumer industry, right? And I think that recycling in particular is a massive, massive challenge for the beauty industry. you know, more and more brands who require packaging are trying to use more planet-friendly options. Of course, you have, you know, a growing plethora of brands who are, you know, zero waste, perhaps just producing formulations in bar form, etc. But that can't always be the case. And at the same time, you have consumers who are have all this skincare and are finishing the skincare and wondering, you know, can they recycle their empties? Like, what do they do with these products that are finished? I'd just love to know your perspective about this, perhaps how you are addressing some of these challenges with your own label and what progress the industry is making in general in this space.
So recycling is one of my, you know, something that I really fight for in this industry. And, you know, when I started, I made sure that our packaging was always glass and aluminium, the majority of it, so that it could be easily recycled, and that everything else that had to be plastic was a white or a clear plastic, which is readily recycled compared to black or blue or green plastic. So that was kind of the start of Lux. And where we are now, we are faced with a really big challenge. And I think that applies to any small brand that's trying to be better for the planet. And the challenge is kind of threefold. There's minimum order quantities that we struggle to meet, particularly for new and innovative planet-friendly things. Design is a problem because design for these kind of packaging items is often patented. So we have to wait for that. And it's usually patented by the big guys. And thirdly, competition for resource. So, you know, a journey I've been going on recently is trying to shift anything we do use in plastic and perhaps even some glass to a percentage of post-consumer recycled. And I'm sure you know, Susanna, from fashion, there is now a huge competition for post-consumer recycled plastic. There's just not enough of it on the market. You know, I feel like it's becoming the latest greenwashing. You know, Nike is using PCR plastic in their shoes, or there's a fashion brand using it all recycled, you know, any of this. It's becoming really hard because if we just keep focusing on using PCR plastics, I don't know that we're having as much of a meaningful change as we'd like to see, because there's just not enough of it being recycled, first of all. But it also greenwashes to the consumer. You know, oh, we've got some PCR plastic. Well, that's not solving the problem. Maybe we shouldn't be using plastic at all. But then going back to the MOQs and designs, you know, there are wonderful companies like Sulapac, I'll think of some other names later, but that make packaging out of entirely biodegradable items. And their MOQs will be 50,000 units for a single cap, you know, which a brand like mine simply can't afford. But second to that, often with these sort of materials, when you're talking about a water-based product or, you know, an oil-based product, they just degrade. You know, I can put my skincare in something as beautiful as Sulapac, but because it's an aqueous product, it's going to last a month and then it's going to eat through the packaging. So there's a huge number of problems that we're trying to solve. And I feel like it's the small brands pushing it forward, but we are really struggling. And one kind of workaround that we've been thinking about for a few years, but this is where I have to appeal to the audience here, because there's a big problem between branding and recycling. And by that, I mean, if all of us small brands could agree to use the same PCR plastic recycled jar cap or dropper for a serum or pump for a cleanser, right? Let's say we all use white ones. That means branding is going to suffer, because on a retail shelf, you know, we're all going to start to look the same, but we're going to have a better effect for the planet. So this is where I say, you know, I need customers to start looking beyond branding and looking towards what that brand is doing, you know, because if we all can band together and do this, we can make a meaningful effect on the planet. You know, we need probably 10 beauty brands to agree to use the same packaging, to access those MOQs, to access this new technology, but we're all going to kind of look the same. So something's got to give. And I don't know what that is. I think it'll develop in the next year or two, but we really need the help of the consumer to push this forward.
That's really, really fascinating. I had no idea that that would be the ramifications of that kind of choice. I think that they say that often it's your marketing and your branding that makes a difference, you know, from one label to another. Of course, you know, I think in fashion there that can ring true in many cases. There are so many brands creating, you know, the same designs, very similar, you know, hopping on the same trends. Again, I think you must have the same in beauty, and you'd know this better than I would, but I think that fashion is once removed, it's on top of our skin and beauty, like skincare, cosmetics is, I feel like there's more care and thought. If I'm speaking from maybe, you know, my own experience, but you're putting something on your skin. You know, it's not as intimate as food, you know, going into your body, but it's there, like touching your face. And, you know, our complexions are, you know, a sensitive, you know, well seen, you know, part of your body. So, you know, there's that emphasis on beauty and, you know, that well-being. So I think that it would be a struggle, I think, like you say, for brands to probably agree to that, but perhaps there's workarounds, perhaps there's, yeah, other things that are as yet unexplored to kind of explore that space, essentially.
And I think this is part of the problem that we face is we as small brands are kind of sitting here waiting for the big guys to do the innovation and make the change because they have the money to do it, right? So we kind of have to sit back and wait for it. And personally, I'm sick of that. You know, yeah. I want us to be able to do something from the grassroots. And there just isn't an easy answer right now, other than us all kind of banding together to do it together somehow. You know, from the actual recycling side of things, you know, luckily in the US, we have things like PACT and TerraCycle, which I know is now in the UK as well and coming to Europe and hopefully coming to Singapore, which does make it easier for people to recycle their beauty packaging. And you know that every single component is going to be recycled. So that is helping, but that's still not solving the problem. I think it helps me from my heart to know I'm putting something in a box that's definitely going to get recycled, you know, rather than just wish cycling as we mostly do at home. But that's not the end of the story. There is so much more to close this loop. And I don't have the answers. I really wish the industry could move a little faster.
Yeah. And I think it echoes the fashion space as well, with brands waiting for the world's biggest brands to, you know, invest in certain technologies to kind of help make things more mainstream. So not only can they potentially become more affordable, but also they can become more digestible, you know, for consumers, like, you know, certain types of fabric usage, etc. To it's almost like you might look to the world's biggest brands with the biggest budgets, marketing budgets in particular, to normalize this. But actually, you're right, it's not happening fast enough. There's too much greenwashing and performative action. And I mean, this is why I'm in the space that I'm in with Zarin, is because I truly, truly, truly believe it's the small independent brands who are really making true steps and with real intention behind changing the status quo and the way things are done for the good of people and planet. I see it, you know, with your own brand, Lux Botanics. I see it with the various other skincare brands that we work with the fashion labels that we work with, and all the entrepreneurs and their intentions. And I think that, and there's actually an article out on Vogue Business, I believe, that was sharing exactly that same sentiment, that smaller sustainable businesses are actually moving the needle more in terms of their sustainability commitments, in terms of their commitments to ethics and transparency, than some of the world's largest brands, which ironically enough have essentially all of the money, if I can be honest.
Yeah.
And I think that just really speaks volumes to, it all comes down to intention, you know, doesn't it? And it comes down to who the people are behind the brand and what they truly value. And I've always said that we don't just need better brands, we need better people behind the brands who give a damn at the end of the day about changing things. And yeah, I mean, I think your work with Lux Botanics is testament to this. Something has to change. But I feel like we are in this shift. You know, I really, truly believe it. It's what keeps me going. And consumers, customers, as citizens, we're all becoming that little bit more savvy. And let's just hope that that can accelerate as well across, you know, B2C, B2B, everywhere, yeah. Right?
I would agree. And I think we have a huge responsibility, considering the consumer shift now because of COVID, towards circular beauty, sustainable beauty, all of these things, ethical skincare, to uphold the standards that we value and to hold people accountable when there is greenwashing, and to call people out on that, brands, because it just damages the space when there is this huge influx of new customers coming to learn and to test and to try. So we've got a very big responsibility right now.
Yes. And moving on with that then, you know, being an independent beauty brand, you know, there are many challenges, as you've just shared, on the recycling side. But just in general, you know, growing a brand in this space is not easy, from, you know, getting your product right to gaining publicity to growing your community and your reputation. Having been on this journey for a number of years now with Lux Botanics, what would your top tips for aspiring skincare or cosmetics entrepreneurs be? And what have been your biggest, or some of your biggest lessons?
I think the most important thing to be an entrepreneur in any space really is grit and determination, because the world's not going to believe in you until you show them your worth. And that's a very long journey to go on. So you really have to have that grit, you know, that drive, that constant force forward. But I think probably the biggest thing is, when my biggest thing is, learning to ask for help. And I often say to people, when I started the business and I was in Singapore, I'm incredibly grateful for that community that I was part of when I started Lux, because I don't think I could have started Lux without that really giving, really caring entrepreneurial community around me that really taught me to ask for help and not be ashamed when I didn't know how to do something. So I think that is really important. And as you grow, realizing that you can't do it alone. And by that, I mean, you need a team. You need a support structure. You need to realize you're not good at everything, and you don't have to be. You know, as my dad always likes to say to me, you got to pay your school fees to learn all the different things. But at some point, you have to ask for help and team members to take those on. So don't try and go on this gritty journey on your own. Ask for help. And when you can, bring in a team.
Amazing. And with that, what do you see or wish to see then for the future of green beauty? There's a number of things that we've discussed, but if we're thinking, you know, the next 6 to 12 months, what would you say you'd love to see the industry move into?
I would love to see a shift towards science, because, you know, as we talked about earlier, the clean journey and then into green, I feel like it became all about, oh, I must use natural. And we have to elevate the conversation beyond that to what actually works for both you and the planet and the people that are harvesting or making those ingredients and packaging the formulations and everything else. We need to have a more holistic conversation, but it needs to come from a scientific point of view. We need to stop bringing brands to market that they have the supposed right certifications. Oh, they're cruelty-free, they're vegan, they're natural. But, you know, that is meaningless now. We don't need more. We need better from what we have. So let's start lifting the bar for all the brands and, you know, consumers as well. We need to lift that education bar and turn it towards science.
I think that rounds off nicely our conversation and into my last question, which is, finally, what does made better mean to you? I think you've sort of summarized it a little bit in your last response, but if you could summarize it, what does made better mean to you?
Made better means to me a holistic consideration of the product or service that you buy, and asking the key questions of, where does it come from and how is it made, and how's it going to benefit me and my community around me? I think you have to ask that question. It has to think about, where does it come from and what's the benefit to me?
Thank you, Janae. This has been such an amazing conversation. I've learned so much, and I always find your perspective on skincare, beauty, and, you know, beauty activism ultimately, which is how I view your work, really, really fascinating. I always learn so much. So thank you.
Thanks, Susanna. It's been great to chat and to connect. Hopefully I can see you face to face in Singapore at some point this year.
Yeah, I hope so.
Thanks for tuning in to Made Better. If you enjoyed this episode, please help us spread the word. Share it on social media, with friends, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts. It helps more people find us. You can also read show notes of this podcast over on our website, Zerin.com. Zerin is a marketplace and media platform connecting you with independent, sustainable brands and content empowering you to consume more mindfully. You can also follow us on Instagram at Zeren_com, and you can find me there too at Susanna Jaffa.